All right, I call this meeting of the Civil Law and Elections Committee to order. The minutes are in your packet, and Representative Dean moves adoption of the minutes for March 7th, 2005. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. We have a long agenda today, members, and what we do not finish by 2:15 or maybe a few minutes after that, we'll reconvene, if necessary, at 4:30, and we'll get through all these bills today. First bill, we're going to move the order around just a little bit based upon other meetings that folks have and some folks who are in from out of town. We're going to start with House File 865, which is Representative Olson's bill. And I will move House File 865 be recommended to pass and sent to the local government committee. Does that sound right? All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And is this your amendment, Representative Olson?
Yes, it is.
All right. I will also move then the amendment, which doesn't have an identifying number on it. How do we do that? All right, I will move what we are calling the A1 amendment. It's in your packet. It's a normal-sized letter sheet of paper.
And Mr. Chair, that amendment is titled at the top, Move to Amend House File 865?
Yes.
Yeah.
As follows.
That's, Mr. Chair, that's language to make it clear in the bill exactly the process we're after.
All right. So I will move the A1 amendment, and I believe we have two small changes to that. On the 7th line down, which is the 6th page 1, we need to add, after page 1, comma, we add the words strike and delete lines 21 to 24. And on the next line, page 1, comma, strike and, I'm sorry, page 1, comma, line 25, comma, strike and delete Secretary of State. So I will incorporate those changes into my amendment. This puts the bill into the order that the author would like. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, House File 865 amends the statutes that govern the process for establishing precinct boundaries and creating maps. We've included annexation language in the bill. That is necessary because cities do not often realize that an annexation, the change of city boundaries, will also change precinct boundaries. This is particularly true in those cities where there's only one precinct. This can result in the Secretary of State's office and counties not being notified of precinct changes and creates a lot of confusion in the election process. The current statute is unclear on this concern. We've included county auditor language, included the county auditor, to ensure that changes can be made quickly to the precinct finder and the statewide voter registration system, as the auditor is responsible for making these changes. House File 865 streamlines the process of getting changes to city and precinct boundaries into the statewide voter registration system, and this ensures that voters are in proper precincts and able to run and vote in new cities into which they have been annexed. Because it is the county's statutory responsibility to maintain their precinct finder, we want to ensure that counties get information about precinct boundary changes as quickly as possible. And that's best handled by dealing directly with their cities. So we're basically establishing and making certain we have good communication between all the units of government involved when there are annexations, and that affects, it really does affect the voting and precinct boundaries. So I have with me previous representative Tony Kalkuski, and we have Todd Bleese on board who runs the GIS system in the Secretary of State's office. And at this point I'd like to have Tony Kalkuski from the Secretary of State's office speak to the bill.
All right. And Mr. Kalkuski, welcome to the committee again, and if you could keep your comments very brief, then we'll open it up for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tony Kalkuski, Secretary of State's office, for the record. I do want to keep it brief, but the major issue and the major change you see in the bill and the process is dealing with annexations. And there have been some issues sometimes with annexations in terms of the process and the precinct finder and going through and making sure that people not only can vote in a new precinct, but are also able to run in their new area that they have been annexed into. And so this sets up a timely process to not only protect the voters, but also to protect any person that's wishing to be a candidate in their new area also. And that's why we're trying to streamline the process.
Thank you. Any questions or comments on the bill or discussion? Seeing none, anything further, Representative Olson?
Appreciate your support.
All right. The chair will renew his motion that House File 865 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the local government committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thanks, Mark.
Next, I'm going to call up Representative Peterson to present her bill, House File 604, which I believe will be an equally brief bill, hopefully. And the chair, since I'm a co-author, will also move House File 604 be recommended to pass and sent to the placed on the general register, I believe. Yes, placed on the general register. Representative Peterson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm here to introduce House File 604, and it comes to you as amended by the Health and Human Services Committee, and it's a companion bill for Senate File 284, authored by Senator Gaither, which passed out of the Senate's Committee on Health Policy and Finance on a voice vote. And I have here with me today Eric Buss, who's the Senior Vice President, General Counsel of Lifetime Fitness. He will be here to answer any questions you might have regarding this bill. And this bill would exempt zero-death pools accessible only by adults from lifeguard requirements. If this bill is passed, zero-death pools would still have to meet the licensing requirements. And this bill would exempt them from one of the requirements during specified times.
All right.
And we would respond to any questions.
Thank you. Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, what is a zero-death pool?
Representative Peterson.
Mr. Chair, it is a pool that starts at zero depth. You know, many of the pools start at 3 feet and you have to jump in. This is one where you have that gradual slope. And in fact, lakes are zero depth pools by any other definition. So it's that kind of a pool.
Other questions or discussion? Representative Dean.
I have a question. Is it Mr. Buss?
Yes.
Is you're with Lifetime Fitness?
Correct.
And does I know in my health club they have daycare facilities for kids. Do you have that in Lifetime Fitness as well?
Mr. Buss, if you could identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Eric Buss, Senior Vice President, Lifetime Fitness and General Counsel. Mr. Chair, yes, we do have daycare facilities within our facilities that accommodate children from the ages of 6 weeks to 12 years of age.
So do you currently have zero-depth pools at Lifetime?
Yes, we do.
Okay. And do you currently have lifeguard facilities or lifeguards who watch these pools,
Mr. Buss,
with children present?
Yes, Mr. Chair. At the times that the zero-depth pools are open and are being utilized by children under the age of 18, we staff them with lifeguards.
And would this continue after this bill is passed?
Mr. Buss.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Yes, it would. There would be no change with respect to staffing when children are using the pools.
Dean.
What about when I know the kids have kind of run of the health club? I'm just wondering if we won't have a situation where there's children that are, it's an attraction to, I know I have a 2-year-old and they like to run in, it's like the beach. Would we have a situation where we could currently have staff available to monitor these toddlers in particular who may be attracted to that, where we're taking away that level of supervision on making them less safe, particularly for toddlers?
Mr. Buss.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Toddlers do not have free run of the facility. Toddlers stay within the child care center, within the facility. Children under the 12 are not allowed to utilize any aspects of the facility without their parents or during family hours. So there aren't 2 or 3 or 4-year-olds wandering our hallways trying to figure out ways to get into the pools.
Well, there are at my health club. So. No further.
Any other discussion or questions? Seeing none, the chairman will renew his motion that House File 604 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Peterson.
Thank you.
Next item is House File 1295, Representative Abrams. Okay. And the chair will move House File 1295 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. Representative Abrams.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, pleasure to be before the Civil Law Committee. House File 1295 is making some technical changes to the process by which monetary claims from other states, countries, federal, and tribal courts are registered in Minnesota. It also removes the requirements that Minnesota state courts process monetary awards in foreign currencies. This will avoid a significant cost for computer upgrades, and also prevents. It also helps in administrative responsibility of monitoring currency exchange rates. I have with me Judge Gary Larson from Hennepin County, who's been talking to the need for this bill. I was just reminiscing with Judge Larson that as a beginning attorney with Briggs & Morgan, I had one of my initial responsibilities was registering a Swiss judgment in Ramsey County District Court in 1978, and I had to get something called letters notary. And I'll tell you, they didn't teach anything about letters notary or how they looked or how you registered these things in law school. It was kind of an interesting process. But Judge Larson could talk about the current state of the law and what this bill does.
Thank you. Judge Larson, if you could introduce yourself for the record and then give us your thoughts.
Yeah. My name is Gary Larson. I'm Assistant Chief Judge in Hennepin County District Court. I think it's a fairly straightforward situation that we're asking for here. Foreign judgments, there are two types of foreign judgments. We call judgments from Florida foreign judgments. And what we do is ask that the judgment that's being transferred here from Florida abide by Minnesota law as to the length of the judgment and the interest rate, unless the judgment creditor provides via an affidavit on a yearly basis a different interest rate and a different term for the judgment. It's extremely difficult and burdensome for my clerks to have to research the law in 49 other states as to the length of the judgment and the interest rate to apply. Our computers have our interest rates in them and our length of judgment in them. In addition to that, I personally handled a case last year where the debtor insisted that the judgment be entered in euros. Our computer doesn't even have a symbol for euros, let alone being able to enter a judgment in euros. After hassling the lawyers with my great persuasive powers, we were able to work through that situation. This just makes more sense for us in our clerk's office.
Thank you, Judge.
And Mr. Chairman, the status of the bill in the Senate is that the author is Senator Rest, and I believe it's on their consent calendar, so I don't think that there's really any controversy about this bill. All right.
Is there anyone else who would like to testify either for or against this bill? Any discussion or questions? I would entertain a motion to place this on the consent calendar as well in the House. Anybody would like to make that?
So moved.
Representative Nelson moves that this be placed on the consent calendar. Seeing no further discussion, Representative Nelson renews his motion that House File 1295 be recommended to pass and placed on the consent calendar. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your courtesies in getting me a quick...
Absolutely. House File 1244, Representative Paulson here. He is on his way. Should I move to another one? Is there another quick draw? So I can
take a break.
All right, we will just take a very short break until one of our authors gets here. Representative Thiessen, would you like to present your bill on the fly here? You're the only author in the room right now.
I don't have any of my testifiers here right now, but why don't we go ahead and if people need to hear from them, maybe we can
That's great.
Hold it.
So the next item on our agenda is House File 1365, Representative Thiessen's bill. The chairman will move House File 1365, recommend that it pass and be sent to
local government.
Local government committee. And do you have an author's amendment?
I have two of them, which we can hand out. And maybe if I can talk about the bill and then the amendments will make more sense.
That would be excellent. Okay. Why don't you go ahead and do that, Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. This is a bill, in my mind, kind of about basic fairness. And some of you who were on the committee last year heard a much more expansive version of this bill. Essentially, what it's getting at is this situation. If a municipal waste hauler, garbage hauler, is providing waste services in a city, and the government, the city government determines that for whatever reason, and there may be legitimate reasons to do it, they want to provide that service instead, and they tell the waste hauler, you can't provide that service here anymore. Currently under law, there's no remedy for that waste hauler to get any recovery for their lost business. What this bill does is create that remedy. And I think that that's probably why it's in civil law, because we want to talk about that remedy. So it's kind of the basic philosophy underlying it is that if the government wants to do a good thing, you know, and whether it's saving streets from extra traffic or whatever that would be, the question really here is, should that individual waste or that individual business pay all the cost of it, or should that cost be, you know, spread out among the people that are benefiting? And so that's kind of just the general overview of what this bill does. It's fairly straightforward, I think, in its application. What it doesn't do, just to be clear, if a city's currently providing the services, the waste hauling services, this bill has nothing to do with that. If the city is currently contracting with people to provide the services and there's a written contract in place with clear expectations, this bill has nothing to do with it. The contract would govern. It's only in a circumstance like in St. Paul and in other communities where the waste hauls actually contract with individual residents and then the city determines we want to do this ourselves. That's the circumstance that applies. Can I go to the amendments?
Does everyone have the A1 amendment? I believe it's just been passed out. The chairman will move the H1365 A1 amendment. Representative Thiessen.
Thank you. And what this amendment does is it defines political subdivision as being cities and towns. It eliminates counties from this. And there were some concerns in this area that the counties had, and so we're just trying to accommodate them. That's really all. And it does that, and it also makes clear that we're talking about waste collection services and not land. We're not talking about landfills. We're not talking about incinerators. It's just the actual garbage haulers. So that's what this amendment does.
Any discussion on this particular amendment, the A1 amendment? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that the A1 amendment be adopted. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative, does everyone have the A2 amendment?
Yes.
All right. The chair will move the H1365A2 amendment. Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This amendment, this was always the intent of the statute, or the proposal, but it just makes clear that if a hauler is engaged in some kind of criminal or fraudulent conduct, the city can terminate their services and leave them that discretion. We just want to make clear that in that circumstance, the city has complete discretion to make that decision.
Any discussion on this amendment? Seeing none, I renew my motion that the A2 amendment be adopted. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
And Mr. Chair, if I could just say one more thing in kind of serving as proxy for the waste haulers that we're thinking this should be a little later. These typically, a lot of these are smaller kind of family-owned or little bit larger than family-owned businesses that provide a lot of these individual contracts. And so the folks that are running these businesses, this is kind of their livelihood. It's, their retirement that they've built up. This is what they've built up. And to leave them with no remedy, in my mind, is, puts them in a very difficult situation over which they have no control, and I think unfair. So that's essentially what they would have told you.
Discussion, Representative Westbrook.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Thiessen, isn't that just normal business? I mean, if a city decides to get another contractor or somebody else or of another business that you're working with decides to get another contractor, I mean, isn't that just normal business to give them a remedy for a city making a decision? I don't quite understand why we would need a special remedy for this.
And that's thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Westrup. That's a fair question. The difference between that circumstance where a business or a city is deciding to try to do business with someone else is that here the city can actually say, you can't do this. So it's not competition. It's actually prohibiting someone from coming in and competing in the market. And a typical business doesn't have that authority. And this would only apply if the city affirmatively says, we're prohibiting you from doing business in a city where you've been doing it in the past. Kind of changes the rules on you. So that's the distinction that I see.
Representative Westrup?
Well, Mr. Chair, maybe it begs a bigger question to be discussed, and that is it proper for cities to eliminate competition on something like waste hauling, where there might be four people that want to provide the service to the city, and if the city wants to control it, the taxpayers and the citizens aren't able to get a competitive price, but I don't know. It might just open up a bigger question that should be asked. What you're saying is cities can actually prohibit competition and business from collecting trash, and there's communities. Is that construction debris and everything, or just residential garbage?
I think we're focusing on the. I think it would be anything. In terms of whether it's construction or residential. Maybe it does raise a bigger question. In fact, last year we had a bill that kind of got more at that. But this is this kind of gets at the issue that seems to be the most compelling right now.
Representative West?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just first a comment, then a question in response to Representative Westrum's comments about that. I know St. Paul, as stated by Representative Thiessen, does have private trash haulers. I know in my alley I've got six or seven trucks going up and down there in a single day, which is one of the reasons why some cities have opted to go to a single provider to eliminate the waste in that respect, no pun intended. But with respect to the legislation we have before us, my question is obviously these trash haulers, Representative Thiessen, have been unsuccessful in any kind of litigation or would potentially be unsuccessful in litigation in terms of constitutional taking. Now, I know with respect to private businesses, if that business is unable to relocate and the government takes it, the government has to pay going concern, which is what we're talking about here. So why is it that these businesses, trash haulers, have been or would be unable to get going concern in a court action on this?
Thank you. Two good questions. To answer the specific question, there's no constitutional protection unless real property is taken. So if you have a store and they take your property and then get rid of your business, you get going concern value. Here there's no real property being taken, and that's why there's no remedy, there's no equivalent remedy. You're absolutely right that if this was a store owner and they came in and through eminent domain took the property and closed down the business, you would have a remedy, and that's maybe another argument in favor of doing something like this. To get at the St. Paul issue, I mean, you raise a concern about the tearing up of the alleys. And I think what this bill gets at is, you know, who should pay the cost of making that improvement of just having one truck that doesn't do so much wear in the alley? Should it be one business, or should it be the people that are actually benefiting, which are the people of St. Paul? I think that's the essential fundamental question here.
Representative Hilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Thiessen, just in general, this seems to me that the effect of this bill would be to preclude any municipality ever doing anything like this. Isn't that really...
Doesn't that
underlie this? Because if you... Presumably one of the reasons that the city might wish to take over the service is that it would be a cost savings and be more efficient than if you make that takeover more expensive than the projected savings. Aren't you basically saying that you're just precluding the possibility here?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hilty. I don't think it's saying that. I think a city can make that decision. It would be a disincentive to a city doing that just because there'd be more cost. But I would just come back again. If there's cost savings and the people of the city are seeing the benefit of those cost savings, should those cost savings come at the expense of one business, or should the cost savings be spread over the people that are actually benefiting? So that would be my answer to that.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Thiessen, I had some folks stop by and explain this thing to me within the last few days, and I've been struggling with it because I didn't like the idea of having a bill termed inverse condemnation when we're dealing with services as opposed to real property. It didn't seem to fit for me, but I understood the issue, and I understand it even more today. And now I think what's troubling me, and I want to ask you, why do people want to come to St. Paul when this seems to be a local issue? Why is it that we feel a need to bring this type of legislation to St. Paul that effectively takes away any local control? Because that's what this would do. And if the response is, well, because the city can squeeze out the little guy, well, the little guy votes for the people that are running the city, so maybe they should just squeeze out the people that are running the city and make sure that it gets handled. My issue is local control versus, Big Brother taking care of everything.
Representative Keeson.
Thank you. I guess I have never kind of viewed this as a local control issue. I mean, this is an issue that takes, it's not just, in, I guess you're saying coming to the capital in St. Paul. It's not just St. Paul that has this issue. I think that we set up rules for people to operate under at the state level all the time. I don't see this as taking over, addressing issues, taking away any local control. The city can continue to make whatever decision they want. This isn't prohibiting the city from making any decision whatsoever. What it's getting at is, this one-way seller, and they may not even be a citizen of that city to throw the people out. And they'd only have one or two votes in doing that. So it seems to me that we're maintaining local control for the city can make any decision they want, but we want that to be done under fair conditions. I mean, one of the examples that comes up is there was circumstances where when we built these waste incinerators to burn waste that they there was problems with flow control because of the Commerce Clause, and they couldn't force the waste. They couldn't force the garbage haulers to kind of enter into agreement. So basically, what the cities would say is, "Well, we're going to put you out of business to do that, to force them to do it." And I don't think that's how government should operate. I just don't think those are the rules that any government should play by. It seems unfair to me, and it seems like the people that are should benefit, the people that are benefiting, should pay again.
Well, but this bill, that I think those are two different issues. It's apples and oranges when we're talking about incinerators versus what we're talking about here. It seems to me, and I do understand that this bill involves more than Representative Lesh's alley.
Yeah.
A little bit more than Representative Lesh's alley. But the issue to me is, if it seems to me it is local control, because you're saying that if you try to take control of this situation locally, you might be answering to lawyers and lawsuits and the list goes on and on, when in fact, if the free market works the way it's supposed to, these folks should be doing a great job and you shouldn't have the complaints and the city shouldn't be stepping in. And if the city does step in, well, then there should be some public outcry or outrage, and they should get rid of the people that are making these decisions rather than always putting it on the Capitol in St. Paul.
Thank you. And I do have some testifiers here now, but just to get at that, I mean, again, I don't think we're prohibiting the city from doing any of that, and in fact, the city is moving in the opposite direction of letting the free market work. This is just to provide a personal remedy, just like you would have you were personally injured, and you would go in and say, "I've been injured, and so I want access to the courts to get to get remediation to that. That's what this is about. It's not about taking any authority away from any cities.
One last one. Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. But the problem is, I think your frame of reference is Minneapolis-St. Paul. What if we're talking about small towns with very limited budgets? It really doesn't leave them much of an opportunity because they could be faced with strapping their citizens with lots of costs in court. I mean, that's the issue that I've got.
And we have some haulers from small towns that can maybe address some of their concerns. I would hope that what a bill like this would do would lead people to negotiate. You know, there's no reason for a city to negotiate at this point. They can just eliminate the business without any remedy. Courts, deal with these types of issues all the time. It's not anything that's going to be, it's not anything unusual in that sense in terms of valuing businesses, and those types of things. I mean, there's a fairly constrained world, I think. So I'm not concerned with runaway lawsuits. Mr. Chair, could I have these folks come down to chat a little bit?
Come on down. Gentlemen, if you could introduce yourselves for the records and give us your testimony.
My name is Mark Stoltman. I'm the general manager of Randy's Sanitation. We're based in Delano, Minnesota.
Right.
My name is Don Williamson. Excuse me. I'm the owner of West Central Sanitation in Wilmer, Minnesota.
All right. Whoever of you would like to speak first, if you could give us your testimony, try to keep it somewhat brief, and then we'll allow people to ask questions.
Okay. I'll try and keep it brief. Randy Sanitation is a company that was formed in 1979. We have locations in Rogers and in Burnsville. And Randy and Sandy started their business with one route and one hauler, which they purchased from a small hauler themselves. And through the course of time, Randy and Sandy built the business based upon the fact that Randy would go out and collect that route during the day, and he'd try and build customers through good service, word of mouth. Sandy would bill them and take customer service calls at home while she was raising the family. They have five boys and a daughter. All five boys are involved in our business right now, and the daughter, who's 10 years old, I'm sure will be when she grows a little older. When Randy and Sandy started their business, they understood that if they worked hard, and they did, it was 14 to 16 hour days for many, many years. I started with them about 12 years ago, and that was the first time they took a break. They were founded in 79, so they decided to take a little bit of a step back and see the end of their family raise. But during those early years, it was 14 to 16 hour days, and they realized if they worked hard, provided good service at fair prices, that they would be able to build a future for their family and a nest egg for their retirement. We understand hard work, and we also understand competition, and one of the things that we always work hard to do is, through our service, increase our business, because as a small company, we're not a company that can go in and buy big chunks of business. We can't even necessarily bid for big chunks of business because it's awfully expensive. It's a tough market, and it's highly regulated, and we understand all those things. We can compete with the large companies. They don't present a problem for us, because I feel that service in the end, local business with good service, will win out over a national company. But we can't compete with cities or towns taking that business that we have and then deciding that they want to either do it or give it to one hauler without recourse. The problem we have with it, and we're involved heavily in the western suburbs, and if you take a city like Maple Grove, where we have about 4,000 customers, we've built those customers for the last 20 years. And I had our finance person put together some numbers for me. And each one of those customers, we've spent between $75 and $105 to get, to have the privilege to haul those customers in an open collection system. And the 75 is on the low end, where a customer will call in and say, you know what, I saw your cart next door, I was talking to the neighbor, sounds like you got good service. And the 105 is when you have to market for the customer. But by the time you purchase the carts and you deliver it and you set it up and you put them into the system and all those things, that's a lot of money. And when somebody could come by and say, you know what, we decided that we want to take this over, a city like that where we'd have to effectively buy three trucks at $200,000 a piece and two semis full of cart, eleven semis worth of carts at $50 each, each holding hundreds of carts. That's not something a company like ours can take on if somebody says, you know what, we want just one hauler. So for us to try and protect our 4,000 customers and take on the additional 15,000 or 12,000 or whatever it happens to be in that community is not feasible for us. So what it comes down to, in the 12 years I've been here, we've purchased 14 companies. Each one of those companies has been small. They've been a company that Randy or Sandy has built a relationship with. They decided it's time to retire, either because they're old enough or because it's so highly regulated they can't stand the politics involved in things. And we purchase those kind of companies. They don't want to sell to a national. They want to sell to us because they know they're going to get their money and they know that that's their nest egg, their retirement, just like it will be for Randy and Sandy someday. Now, when we have organized collection come in and try and take that business from us, it puts us in a position that we can't compete in. We don't have the money for it. That's just the bottom line.
Thank you, Mr. Stoltman. Mr. Williamson, did you have anything to add?
Yes, I do, if I may. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, like I said, I'm Don Williamson from Wilmer, Minnesota. We are in a smaller area of the state, more of a rural area, smaller communities. I have been in business for 25 years, started with one truck, and today we have 50 employees. We're thankful for that and for the many counties we're able to serve in out there. Most of our business is subscription-type business. And when I say subscription, I mean we don't have a lot of municipal contracts because in our part of the state, there's not been a lot of municipal providers of the service, or the municipalities or counties have not decided to organize the collection and thereby bid it out and handle it by contracts. So it's people move in, they pick up the phone, they look in the yellow pages, they decide who they want to haul their trash, and that's what I would call subscription service. So the length of our contract with the customer is based on how good of a job we do and how fair our prices are. And so I've got customers, fortunately, that have been with me for 25 years now, and I'm thankful for that. Let me get right to my example. We've been able to grow our business by competition. We've also been able to grow sometimes when there's been a hauler that is getting older and wanting to retire and sell his truck or two and get out of the business. We just purchased a small operation a year and a half ago down in Yellow Medicine County, and I've known that hauler for many years, and I knew the guy before him for 10 years before that. Mayor Roy Lenson from Granite Falls had his business for 20 some years and his family, and he was a mentor to me. And then when he had cancer, he sold out to the Olson brothers from the Dawson area. And Dan Olson had some family difficulties 2 years ago and had to get out of the business and needed to exit. He called me up because we'd been friendly competitors, you might say, in that our areas were adjacent to each other. And when there was a tornado in Granite Falls, we helped him out with equipment and so forth. Anyway, Mr. Olson needed to get out of his business. He came to us. We purchased his business. Much to my dismay, 2 months later, a small town by the name of Echo, it's a small community, but almost nepotism, I don't know what else you'd call it, I won't get into all the details except that we lost the right to haul our 103 customers, which doesn't sound like a lot, in that community because after 30 years of they had never organized their community. There was no ordinances governing collection. It was just the Lenson operation had hauled their trash all these years, had great relationships with all these customers. Mr. Olson had done the same for 11 years. We came in and were doing the same, and all of a sudden the city decided to yank the rug out from underneath us. We had no price increases, no service issues. We weren't illegal. In fact, all the records will show that we were well received by the community, but somebody in the council decided to give it to a friend. And I don't know how else to say it, so they organized their community, and we lost the right to serve our 103 customers in that community. And I'm not going to really don't like to go into lawsuits or anything to defend my right to serve a customer, but if I had known that, would I have bought that business? No, I would not have. And does that hurt us financially? It certainly does. Will I make my payments good to Mr. Olson? I will. But that's what I'm up against, and that's what we're up against when a community wants to take your right. And like I said, we understand that right, don't mind the right of the community to do that, but there are repercussions that are financial that somehow have to be dealt with.
Thank you, Mr. Williamson. Representative Ellison.
Representative Thiessen, just having heard the testifiers, let me just get something in my mind that's now, that I don't know if I quite understood before, but now I think I do. What you're trying to do is when a hauler has a relationship with a customer to stop government from intervening in that relationship. See, I was under the impression that you were trying to address like a contract that that one company had with a city and stop the city from just, say, not renewing their contract with the hauler. Or you're talking about customer to customer. Am I right?
Representative,
that is right. In fact, the bill in the second subdivision says that there is a contract that doesn't apply.
Okay.
And just to be clear, we're not prohibiting that. We're just saying if you're going to do it, you ought to compensate someone.
Right.
Members, what I'd like to do is ask Mr. Johnson from the League of Minnesota Cities to come forward. He wanted to offer some testimony. And also ask, is there anyone else who would like to testify for or against this bill? All right, I see one more person. What I'm going to do is have you present your testimony, and then I think we'll, Representative Thiessen, lay this bill over so that Mr. Representative Paulson can present his bill. We will come back to yours as soon as we're done with that and take a vote on it. Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Craig Johnson, representing the League of Minnesota Cities. We have worked on this bill in the past with Representative Thiessen, very appreciative of how he has tried to narrow the scope of it, but still have a number of concerns with how this bill would work and unintended consequences that are included in it. Very clear that it's not the author's intent to prevent cities from planning for their community, using local control to decide how to best provide public services and make sure garbage is collected. But the unintended consequences of this bill will, in fact, do that. When a community is looking at organized collection, they might be doing it for any number of reasons. They might be doing it because they have a local waste facility that they are trying to make sure gets proper flow of solid waste. So they try and arrange contracts that will address that. It could be a municipal facility. It could be a county facility that the city is being asked to draft contracts to support. But we have a number of cities that have their own waste management facilities that this can affect. Secondly, as a community is looking at making decisions on solid waste organized collection, first of all, Chapter 115A in this state encourages cities to do organized collection as the most efficient way to make sure that good environmental priorities are being used and that they have some knowledge of how the solid waste that their community is generating is being handled, because they have liability down the road if that solid waste is not handled well. Communities frequently get brought into Superfund suits over this down the road. The final part of the contract issues here is the kind of the chilling effect that if a community is sitting there trying to make a decision on whether to go into organized collection or not, this doesn't say they can't do it, but it does say that they are facing a virtually unlimited unknown liability of going concern if they decide to. So if your options are go into court against a solid waste company and find out how much money they get as an award for their going concern, or just keep letting things go the way they are, a responsible elected body would really not be able to make that decision without knowing the exact fiscal implications. No one elected would regularly do that. There's a few hypothetical cases. I appreciate the amendment the author offered to deal with bad actors. We do have cases where that occurs, but the way the qualifications work for a person bringing an action in this are that the local government either begins to directly provide the service or they limit the number in some way of private parties that are able to provide it. And then secondly, that because of a government's action, a particular provider is no longer able to continue to provide service in that area. And then third, that that person would have been able to substantially continue to provide that if the action had not occurred. Well, in a community that already has organized collection, say for instance that a community has six contracted solid waste providers in their community, they determine that one of those is one they do not want to continue with and replace it with a different contract. That person meets those criteria. That company now meets those criteria. They are not under contract. They are not being told they can't provide business because of a failure to meet their contract. They are simply being replaced by a different hauler. And what that does is the city does meet those criteria. They limit the number to six. The person involved did used to provide solid waste. The person involved no longer can because someone else has been given that contract, and they aren't eligible under the they aren't limited by the exemption that a contract is limiting this. So our concerns on this is that this is a very significant unknown liability, and it really does have the effect of saying that we don't want to do organized collection. We feel it would be much more appropriate if the state's goal is to stop organized collection because they feel it impinges on competition in the solid waste industry, to go to Chapter 115A, which is solid waste law, and change it so that organized collection is not the priority of the state that is put forward to local governments as the best means of addressing the problem. Finally, we do have concerns about what this can do for driving up costs. Cities do not have a way other than limiting the number of solid waste haulers to force anyone into entering a contract for solid waste services. If it's just open competition, there is no reason that a hauler would need to enter into any contract with a local unit of government, and so all haulers would always be exempt from the provisions that a contract might otherwise provide. And the only way a city could have any further controls would be to try and limit the number of them. So it would raise certain concerns for there's no incentive for someone to improve their services other than the ones that maybe the minor free market issues would bring to bear. But in many of our smaller communities, there aren't 17 companies trying to get your solid waste business. There's two or three. And if the local community has no control over how those services get provided directly, it definitely could have an effect on the public services in that area. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll end my testimony and answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Benke, did you want to come forward? Members, if you could hold your questions and maybe jot them down, what I'd like to do is get all the testifiers in, lay the bill on the table so we can get through Representative Paulson's bill and then come back to this. Mr. Benke, if you could introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is David Benke. I'm the Strategic Directions Manager at the Office of Environmental Assistance. I want to thank you for the opportunity to come forward today and provide a little input from the office's standpoint. This bill, I think, has evolved some from its original introduction, and we appreciate the author's ability to take a look at the issues that are coming forward and try and find remedies through changes in the language. I think the office still has concerns about the issue in relationship to providing public health protection and welfare for the citizens of the state. We recognize that recovering resources from garbage, protecting the health by having proper disposal for the waste is a goal for the state. And one of the mechanisms that the local units of government have utilized is occasionally using organized collection to do some of that. And we want to make sure that that tool is available for them. The current organized collection process, I think, allows for public debate and discourse over how it will be implemented. It's a lengthy process, and not a lot of cities and or counties have gone through the process because of that. Adding an additional burden to that might provide this as a disincentive. And I just go back to Tuesdays, because Tuesdays is garbage day in my neighborhood. We've got 9 licensed haulers, I believe, in the community now. And that's the same day that I have bus duty. So I watch as we put the kids on the bus, and we see 9 licensed haulers providing 3 different services, or 27 trucks roll through the neighborhood at the same time. And there may be some efficiencies gained by organized collection that go beyond just strictly the health and safety aspects for the kids in terms of the roads and other things. And it should be up to the community through a public process to decide on doing that and not have another disincentive provided. We're committed to working with the author on changes and provide more input on that. So with that, I will end my testimony.
All right. There is someone else who has asked to testify, Mr. Tilley. If you could come forward and provide us with your brief testimony, if possible, then we're going to lay this bill on the table.
Mr. Chairman, if you're going to lay it on the table, I can wait until you take it back up, if you'd like.
We intend to take it back up as soon as the next bill is done, so I'd like to get all our testimony in first.
And I make that offer because the person that really should be testifying on behalf of our group, I just left another meeting, and she's right behind me, and she will be here in a couple of minutes. She's better able, I can do the testimony, but she's more informed.
If you could provide us with your testimony, that would be great.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Barry Tilley, and I'm here representing the Solid Waste Management Coordinating Board, which is a joint powers board made up of most of the metro counties in the metropolitan area. And the coordinating board performs basically the same functions as the Office of Environmental Assistance for those counties in the metro area. Basically, we coordinate among ourselves these same programs that involve all of the solid waste management, the recycling, all the incentives to not put stuff in landfills and that sort of thing. And I realize that an amendment's been adopted that removes counties from this bill, but I would like to point out that the solid waste management system in the metropolitan area is very much a partnership between the counties and the cities in performing those goals. All of the recycling efforts and the solid waste collection efforts and the various solid waste management practices that occur in the metro area are all very closely linked. The counties administer the SCORE grant program that provides the incentives to the financial incentives to the cities to do the recycling programs that keep all of these good recycling materials that from going to the landfills, but are instead are reused for, in various manufacturing methods. There's a very good reason that Minnesota has among the highest in the country with the recycling rates, because we have such a cohesive unit of working together with between the cities and the counties and the private hauling community as well as the waste processing facilities to administer these programs. We see the passage of this bill as taking away one of those tools that's utilized by cities to coordinate their solid waste management collection process within their cities. And we think it would do harm to the overall effectiveness of our solid waste management system in the metropolitan area and open the door for some huge potential liabilities into the future. And I'd be more than happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Tilley. I appreciate you stepping in. Before I lay this on the table, let me just ask, are there questions or discussion on this bill? There is. Okay. I will lay this on the table until after Representative Paulson's bill. Representative Thiessen, thank you. Representative Paulson? That's right. We'll get to your question. Representative Paulson? House File 1244, Representative Paulson's bill. The chair will move House File 1244 be recommended to pass and re-referred to Public Safety. And I believe we have some amendments as well. They haven't been passed out yet. Representative Paulson, if you want to talk about your bill a little, and then we can talk about the amendments, that would be great.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe I'll explain the bill briefly. We've had essentially almost two hearings in Public Safety already. I think after hearing some of that testimony, I have two amendments that we'll bring forward. I'll describe those after I just talk about the context of the bill. And then I think it's going to go back to Public Safety for perhaps some more revision. But essentially, members, the legislation that is before you today is something that's going to help keep violent offenders and repeat violent offenders off the streets and requiring the use of advanced technology for identification and investigation. There is no doubt that the most powerful tool that law enforcement has available today is the use of, and in order to prove the truth, is the use of DNA technology. It is more accurate, more reliable, and a necessary element to help identify the guilty, exonerate the innocent, and provide swift justice for victims. And so the proposal before you does three things. First, it eliminates the sunset on the current DNA collection efforts for convicted felons. Secondly, the legislation requires DNA samples from persons that are arrested for felony-level charges for violent felonies taking place in July 1st, 2005, so that at the time of booking, the DNA tests would be collected at that time. Examples of the offenses would include murder, manslaughter, assault, burglary, kidnapping, other criminal sexual conduct crimes. The reason that I chose this to implement this first, for a couple of reasons. One is the severity of the crimes, and the collecting the DNA upon arrest in these cases will definitely have the opportunity to prevent additional crimes from happening and possibly help solve other crimes. As an example, in Chicago, there's been examples of someone who's paroled on a felony theft conviction, gave a DNA sample. They matched that DNA sample with several other rapes and a murder, and locked somebody up 10 years later, where the victim still would have been alive had they had the ability to capture that individual earlier. Secondly, the offenses that are identified here are also the original offenses for which Minnesota and other states did begin collecting DNA, as we do currently for convicted felons. The second portion of the bill really is an expansion for any person arrested on felony charges starting in July 1st, 2010. That essentially gives the state some time to adjust to collecting the broader level of base of samples and analyzing the samples and storing the information. We've had a number of discussions about the privacy concerns, about the privacy rights of citizens. I can assure you that we've taken some steps to ensure that this bill will not infringe on the constitutional rights of citizens. An arrestee that is found not guilty, who does not have a felony conviction within the preceding 10 years, is allowed to petition a court to have their information expunged from the DNA database and sealed. And we have an amendment I'll talk about in just a second that also clarifies that. In addition, there's language that classifies DNA records as private data on individuals. That is not the case right now with current DNA, so that it is accessible only to law enforcement and the individual is the subject of the data. This technology is not new. 34 states across the country collect DNA from convicted felons, and 4 states collect it for arrestees, Virginia, California, Texas, and Louisiana. And as we heard in testimony previously from the law enforcement community and county attorneys, as an example, it has been tremendously successful in the state of Virginia alone. They produce 300 to 400 hits per year, cold hits per year, through this technology, keeping bad guys off the street. So, Mr. Chair, that's just a brief description of the bill. There are 2 amendments that I can describe as well that I think address most of the privacy concerns that I think are the purview of this committee.
All right, Representative Paulson, we have, I believe everyone has, the A1 and the A2 amendment. I will move the H1244A1 amendment, and if you'd like to speak to that, Representative Paulson.
Mr. Chair, the A1 amendment addresses several of the privacy concerns that some opponents have raised, and we may hear some testimony on that today, and it corrects a few technical issues. First, the amendment inserts a section to provide a technical cross-reference for the data privacy statutes in Chapter 13. Secondly, the amendment revises a reference to the year 2010, just to make sure we're clear in 2010. That's a technical change. But third, more importantly, the amendment limits the use of DNA records for law enforcement identification purposes. We had some discussion in previous committee hearings about that, so it can only be used for law enforcement identification purposes. Fourth, the amendment inserts a cross-reference to civil remedies that are established in Chapter 13. That cross-reference then would authorize arrestees who have had their DNA samples and records misused to file suit to recover damages from the party who misused the DNA, similar to other similar remedies in Chapter 13.
All right, any discussion on this particular amendment? Seeing none, the motion is to adopt the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. The chair will also move the H1244A2 amendment. Representative Paulson, if you could explain that to us.
Mr. Chair, the A2 amendment essentially goes in the direction of making the DNA sampling. I've argued that DNA is essentially the fingerprint of the 21st century, and it's an extension of fingerprint technology. And so what this amendment does is amends the bill so the DNA samples and the records are treated the same way that fingerprints are with regard to arrestees who are not convicted of a crime or who have their criminal records expunged. Specifically in paragraph B, we're identifying it so that a person would merely need to request that his DNA sample be removed from the BCA database and returned along with related records if the charges are dismissed prior to determination of probable cause or the prosecuting authority refuses to file charges. Again, that's to provide similarity to our fingerprint laws that are in place right now. Secondly, down in paragraph C, it does permit an arrestee who submitted a DNA sample to have the sample and the records sealed if the person's not convicted, if they receive an expungement order, and if they've not had a felony conviction within the last 10 years. Again, these provisions are substantially identical to those currently covering fingerprint records.
Thank you, Representative Paulson. Any questions on the A2 amendment? Representative Paulson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, my first point is that, you know, a fingerprint, what you have based on that information is, you know, how many swirls and how many dips and changes on the end of your fingers. But from DNA, you could tell whether somebody has a proclivity for a disease or a genetic defect of some kind. I mean, there's just much, much more information you can gain, much more private, personal information. In fact, as we study the human genome, you might have a complete roadmap or blueprint to a human being based on a collection of DNA, which I think is a far cry from fingerprint information. So I just want to be a voice in opposition to this idea that this is just super fingerprint information or something. It's much, 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 much more than that. But I guess to the amendment, I'd like to ask this question. Does this amendment still allow for a collection of DNA evidence in the absence of judicial oversight?
Representative Paulson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, the collection of DNA would still occur upon arrest, correct, for a violent offender for the first phase of the bill. That is correct.
Representative Ellison.
And does this amendment still allow for collection of DNA where the person is not necessarily suspected of an offense that would involve DNA? For example, I mean, if the question is clear to you, I could clarify it if you'd like me to. For example, if somebody is receiving unemployment benefits and they get a job and they don't tell the government, that's a crime. But it's hard to see how DNA evidence would be implicated there. Does your amendment still allow for just sort of like a prophylactic collection of DNA evidence, even cases where DNA evidence is unlikely to be implicated?
Representative Paul.
Mr. Chair and Representative Elson, following the question correctly, essentially the language would still allow the collection of DNA if someone is arrested on a felony for a felony.
Representative Westrup.
You seem to get me with cauliflower every time, Mr. Chair. Representative Paulson, on the last question, and then I had another question earlier, but on the last question, I thought in your testimony you said it would only be collected for the violent felonies, murder, burglary. In your response to Representative Ellison just now, sounded like they were going to collect on any felony. Is that which is it? I didn't understand which was.
Mr. Chair, Representative Weston, just so I'm clear again, there's two stages of the bill. Essentially, the first stage is that starting in 2005, DNA would be collected for felony arrestees for violent felony charges. That would be kidnapping, murder, etc. Those are the original crimes that were collected for the existing BCA database. Starting in the year 2010, it would be expanded at that time to all felony arrestees.
Okay, Mr. Chair, to the amendment, I don't believe we've put that on, have we?
No.
To the amendment, you say it's the same process to expunge your records or to get rid of your DNA evidence from the BCA database. Explain it a little bit more to me. If there's no charges filed or the charges get dropped, then you can have it removed. But if you go through a trial and they're found innocent or not convicted, then you still can't have the DNA evidence removed, but they can seal them. Did I understand that right? And what's the difference?
Representative Paul.
Representative Johnson, Mr. Chair, Representative Westrum, and we can have counsel comment on this. We had some lengthy discussion in the previous committee about this issue, and in terms of, again, having a discussion about DNA being an extension of current fingerprint technology. And so it would only make sense to sort of apply the same rules that apply to for an individual wants to obtain either their fingerprint records expunged or receive that paperwork back. And so working with council and others, that was the suggestion essentially. And I can have them, council can comment exactly if there are some differences, but essentially it would require that a person would merely need to make the request that his DNA sample be removed from the database and returned with related records if the charges were dismissed prior to the determination of probable cause or if the prosecuting authority refused to file charges.
Mr. Chair, Representative Paulson, then I think I heard it right, but why would, if somebody's found innocent after a trial, why would that not be the same circumstance to return the database and the DNA material?
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrum, and again, I'm not sure that is done with fingerprints right now, and council can comment on that. Again, we were just applying the same standards to the fingerprints, Representative Westrum, just so you know.
Representative Hilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Paulson, I hadn't really had a chance to read through this bill prior to the meeting, and I'm sorry I had to step out for a moment, so maybe you already covered this, but what use does this bill provide for of the DNA information? Is this for identification only, or are there any restrictions on the way that this information, this sample, could be used?
Right. And Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, in the First Amendment that we adopted, it does clarify that the data can be used only for law enforcement identification purposes. That was specifically laid out. Secondly, it's my understanding, and the BCA is here to testify if you'd like them to as well. They've testified previously. But essentially, the DNA is tested only for 13 different identifiers currently. It's those 13 identifiers that are used for matching up to within the existing database.
Representative Hilty.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Paulson, then, it would not be possible to use collected DNA evidence to, for instance, and I don't know to what extent this is possible currently, but it certainly seems like it's likely to be more possible in the future, for instance, to do a psychological profile of a person based on their genetic composition.
Representative Paulson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, I'm unprepared to answer that type of a question, but again, in the discussion we've had, and the BCA is here to testify, but there's really just 13 identifiers that they use, that they use within their database just to match it up for other crimes or having people permanently on the database.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Paulson, are there restrictions as to what can be, what happens to the sample between the time of its collection and the time of its return, if it's found, if the person from whom it's collected is not charged or found innocent?
Sheriff is unhealthy, essentially, I believe, and the BCA is, again, is here to testify and answer these questions, but essentially I think the sample is housed or kept secure under current law, it can never be expunged. But this goes a little step further to allow that expungement.
Well, this Chair, Representative Paulson, the basis for my question is, I believe your initial comments were that this is often used to track cold cases in which these samples can be used to identify perpetrators from some time past. Would it be possible to use these samples to attempt to make those kinds of matches in the period of time between when it was collected and when it would be returned if the person was not charged?
Sure, Representative Hilty, I believe that would be correct. Once the sample is placed or is captured, it would be put in the database and would be used as, in Virginia, for instance, the 300 to 400 hits that are obtained per year. There's the opportunity for additional cold hits. That's correct.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Paulson, it kind of renders the sealing of the records or returning of the sample kind of moot, doesn't it, if you already used it for any information that you wanted to get prior to your returning it?
Well, Mr. Chair, as I held, I don't think so. In fact, I think that's where the testimonies come in the other committee, is that just similar to fingerprints, I think individuals may want to request that information back if someone is eventually found innocent or charges are not filed, for instance. And again, the BCA may be able to answer some more detailed questions on this, if you'd like, Mr. Chair.
Sir, did you have anything you'd like to add to that particular question? And if so, if you could introduce yourself, please.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, my name is Frank Dolish. I'm the director of the BCA laboratory. In response, and Virginia does have a law similar to this in place right now, and they run them as soon as they come in, and sometimes those samples are later expunged. And I guess my response to that, they're legal until they're not legal. In other words, it was legal to take them because the law says they're arrested, and so that's why you're taking them, to put them in the database. And so don't expect that they're not going to be put in until such time as all of this is maybe terminated. In terms of, I think that Representative Paulson has referred to this a couple times, what we're looking for are that part of the DNA that has to do with just identification characteristic. We're looking at some regions that, at least at this point in time, I'd say don't code for proteins and things that would be of any interest to anybody else. We particularly look at these areas because they are so different between individuals. Could it be used for something else? I think the law specifically says that we can't use it for anything else but identification purposes and for law enforcement purposes. In terms of what happens to that sample, right now we're taking buccal swabs, which are cells taken off the inside of your cheek, and we do maintain those samples, as I testified in an earlier committee, for a number of legitimate reasons. One is that as the technology evolves, we may actually be looking at other identifying characteristics using different technology, and if we can't go back and rerun them when a new technology comes along, all those samples that would have been collected would be rendered worthless. And that did happen already since we've had this process in place. And we did have to go back and rerun those samples to be able to include them using current technology. The second reason is when we get a hit, we like to be able to go back to that sample and rerun it to verify that there was no mix-up. So it's a protection for the individual that's in the database so that we don't imply that they're involved without double-checking that. And then we go on to a third step, and we actually ask law enforcement to go back and get a new sample from that individual that we would run that now becomes part of the criminal case.
Thank you. Representative Lesh.
My question's been asked, Mr. Chair.
All right. We have several testifiers, that would like to testify in opposition to the bill. Representative Paulson, did you have anyone else you wanted to testify at this point?
No, we've had numerous others in other committees. I think you're still on the A2 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Oh, that's
happy
right.
To hear other people testify.
Why don't we go ahead and vote on that, the A2 amendment, to put the bill into the form that the author would like. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. All right, we have the bill before us. Mr. Neumeister is Rich here? Yes. You could come forward, introduce yourself for the record, and give us your thoughts, please. And briefly, if you can.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Richard Neumeister. Let's start. In Minnesota, to paraphrase a law review article that I read, in Minnesota, should an arrest itself be sufficient cause to include the DNA, which is a sample and profile, of the individual arrested in a DNA database, even in the absence of an eventual finding of guilt? My answer to that is no. Now, since the last committee meeting, I've worked with Representative Paulson on some of these issues. What you have before you now is the amended, is basically going back to old law of 299C11, but putting it in the version for DNA. One of the questions I have, and this is important, when you look on the probable cause standard, this would be on page 1 of the A2 amendment, to determination of probable cause. The issue is that what it comes down to, it doesn't really come down to a factual type of issue. It comes to a court case that was done, and I think it was, I forget the name of the court case, I'm sure Representative Paulson may know. It deals with the issue that what they call what probable cause is. Based on the totality of the circumstances, if a prosecutor decides that's what the probable cause standard would be, after the totality of circumstances, the individual would be able to get his stuff back, with fingerprints, DNA, or whatever. So that's one of the issues that I think that may come into play here. There's also, if you take a look at the suggested amendment, if the prosecutor decides to do the charges. So that's one area where I have a concern with. Also, I want to mention to you what some figures are, and this is based from Virginia. In the first year, in year January 1st, 2003, Virginia basically is doing what we are proposing to do in regards to violent offenders. There were 7,836 folks arrested. This is now adults. 200, and this is the breakdown of those for 1 year. 210 samples were destroyed, not associated with the offense that they were arrested for. 1,764 dismissed, what they call nol pros, or I don't know the legal term on that. 73 were outright acquitted. 939 were reduced to misdemeanors. So that will be one of the questions that you have to ask yourselves as policymakers. If you're arrested for a felony, it's then reduced to a misdemeanor, would I be able to use the 299C11 statute based on that? I think that's an important area to deal with. One of the other things that I have a concern about is who is going to make sure that the sample is destroyed. Now, the current law basically uses the word demand. So I go to the local BCA or the BCA office, or I go to the local police shop and I say, I demand. And based on the demand, there's certain kinds of criteria whether or not I'm going to get the stuff back or particularly the samples. So who's going to do the legwork? In Virginia, talking to the equivalent of Frank over there in Virginia, they basically do a lot of the work themselves. So that's one of the issues that you've got to address. For me, it's important for the BCA to do some of that stuff, to say, well, hey, you individual, you do the stuff. I mean, most states, and I'm getting into some of this stuff, is the entity does a lot of the work to help that individual. So I think that's an issue, and that's also a cost factor. I also want to make comments in regards to about juveniles. This is still an issue. It comes into play because civil law, I think, covers at least a lot with juveniles, particularly in the area of rehabilitation and all that. Is currently the law says that juveniles arrested for felonies, both serious, which takes effect July 1st, and in 2010, it will happen. At least from my own reading of the California, which this is based on the ballot, which was done based on a ballot initiative, not where it went through a legislative process for thorough discussion, but on a ballot process, they do not include juveniles based outside of the felony or the serious felony offenses, as much as I can tell by reading the statute. So that's an area that I would encourage Mr. Paulson to take a look at as time goes on. The other thing I want to make comments on, he put into law, or on the Amendment 1308, putting it to the Data Practices Act. The issue is that deals with data, the data itself, a disclosure of the data. I don't think it deals with the samples. So some of the questions, what happens with the misuse of DNA samples? Right now, I'd like to see that as a felony. I don't see where something about that. There should be a private cause of action for individuals when there's a misuse of the DNA samples. Penalties for tampering with DNA samples. Now, one of the other things that, again, you talk about the law enforcement. This has been changed since last committee. It's for law enforcement ID. Now, what does law enforcement ID mean? Does it mean that samples, when there's missing deceased or missing persons, and they find a body, and law enforcement is more than likely the first folks there, can they use the DNA database for those kinds of purposes? How about for natural mass disasters, where they find people not fully identifiable? Also, what a lot of states have been using is what they call population statistical databases. Now, I don't know if the BCA is doing this or not, but those are at least some concerns I have in that regards. And the last two final items is, and you were just talking about it here, how does suspects and arrestees and included in the database? One of the issues that I think is interesting is how you set up the process of whether or not BCA will know whether a person has been cleared or not. One of the things that happens, and it goes to a little, this is called creating and maintaining an arrestee database in Virginia. Policy and practical aspects. And one of them, I'd like to encourage you, Representative Paulson, is we're going to go forward with the bill, move it to January 1st, 2006, because there's been a lot of issues, at least with Virginia when they started theirs, is that conversely, so let's say a hit is made at any time prior to official notification of clearance of the arrestee. So in BCA, if I don't go on demand and I'm clear, I know I'm clear, what happens, as long as that thing is in the database, I might get a hit. I might be somewhere where I was just there, and all of a sudden, oh, Neumeister pops up. And then I might be asked where you were or whatever. I'm just saying those kinds of things can happen. Conversely, if notification of clearance to the BCA, or in this case Virginia, of charges is received prior to a hit, the hit is not reportable. In other words, in Virginia, if the case is reported, hey, Neumeister's clear, even though it remains in the database, it cannot be used down the line for something else.
Mr. Neumeister, could you wrap up your testimony?
So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, those are just some concerns that I raised. And I'm sure, as I shared with Representative Paulson, this is a work in progress, and he's acknowledged that, I assume, that things will happen as time goes on.
Thank
you very much for the few moments of your time.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Neumeister? Is Michael Darling here? All right, doesn't appear he's here. Howard Bass? Mr. Bass, if you could come forward and introduce yourself for the record and give us your testimony as briefly as you can.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Howard Bass. I am a former president of the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. I'm here today to testify in opposition to House File 1244 because, as a matter of public policy, persons who have not been convicted of a crime simply do not belong in a criminal DNA database. With the exception of California, three states currently collect DNA samples from felony arrestees: Louisiana, Texas, and Virginia. States which I would submit the great state of Minnesota should not pattern itself after. Moreover, there is no need to collect arrestee DNA data. As of a year ago, the combined DNA index system, CODIS, included more than 1.5 million convicted offenders' DNA. Storing DNA taken from arrestees as opposed to convicts in a criminal database is wrong for many reasons. First, it undermines the presumption of innocence upon which the American criminal justice system is built. Second, it sets an absolutely chilling precedent for the collection by the government of data from its citizens. Third, it violates constitutional protections against unreasonable searches and seizures. Fourth, it is inconsistent with notions of fundamental fairness. Fifth, it completely disregards principles of privacy. And sixth, the permanent retention of juvenile offender information cannot be reconciled with our longstanding commitment to rehabilitation in the juvenile justice system. I submit that this bill, if adopted, will alter the purpose of Minnesota's DNA database from criminal investigation to population-level surveillance. It will foster a criminal justice system that relies more on cold hits than traditional, thorough law enforcement investigation. The result of that will be a more error-prone system, which undermines the defendant's right to a fair trial and the integrity of the trial's search for truth. Contrary to some of the information presented to this committee today, DNA is not essentially the extension of fingerprint evidence. It reveals far more than fingerprint evidence. Fingerprint evidence reveals nothing more than an individual's identity. DNA evidence reveals not only an individual's identity, but their medical, their genetic, and other private information. In fact, their entire genetic code, and beyond that, the entire genetic code of not only the individual sampled, but every person who shares that individual's bloodline. The First Amendment that was recently adopted by this committee ensures that the DNA specimens will only be used for law enforcement purposes of identification. And currently there are 13 identifiers, although as the gentleman from the BCA just acknowledged, more identifiers will be used as technology improves. History teaches us that information compiled for one purpose will be used for another. The Social Security numbers that we all have were initially used only to track Social Security payments. They are now a universal identifier. Census records were created for general statistical purposes. However, during World War II, they were used to round up innocent Japanese Americans and confine them in internment camps. There is a great potential for DNA data bank abuse, including genetic discrimination by employers, insurers, and or healthcare providers. Moreover, contrary to popular perception, DNA is neither permanent nor incontrovertible. Samples cannot be maintained indefinitely. They degrade, and as they degrade, they become more difficult to type and more prone to error. Testing is not infallible. There have been thousands of documented problems in the areas of collection, handling, and storage of DNA samples, analytical errors, and reporting errors. Currently, there are thousands of cases being reviewed from labs in Houston, Fort Worth, Oklahoma City, Baltimore, Phoenix, West Virginia, Montana, and Washington. These reviews demonstrate that widespread problems associated with handling and analyzing DNA evidence exist and demonstrate the fallibility and limitations inherent in DNA testing. Now, it's one thing to collect DNA specimens first from convicted sex offenders, as the legislature initially adopted years ago. Then it was expanded to all convicted felons, but only for a year. Then it was expanded until it sunsets, I think, this summer. This bill will extend that so that all convicted felons will have to submit samples of their DNA. While I'm not here to testify specifically against that, one of the representatives, I believe it was Representative Ellison, pointed out that in those circumstances there is at least judicial oversight. None exists when you're dealing with law enforcement officers. The two amendments that were, or the second amendment that this committee just adopted, I'd like to speak to that. I think it cures some, but certainly not all of the problems in this bill. I would propose that instead of returning identification data and DNA samples and records in cases where there is no probable cause, meaning that a case was dismissed without a finding of probable cause or no charges were filed, that instead of requiring the arrestee, the innocent arrestee, to have the onus of making a demand for the return of that data, it should be automatically returned for several reasons. The burden shouldn't be on the innocent citizen to retrieve this identification data and DNA specimens, particularly in cases where there was no probable cause, not even to charge them. Secondly, the demand, based on my experience, and I've practiced criminal defense in this state for more than 15 years and done a lot of expungement work, the demand is, in a large part, a meaningless remedy. I'll tell you the way it works in the real world. We make a demand on a law enforcement agency.
Could you try to wrap up your testimony soon?
It's a meaningless remedy, and there's a compliance problem with law enforcement agencies. I would also encourage you, if you were to pass this bill, to further amend it so that when a person obtains an expungement order pursuant to 609A, when a case is resolved in their favor, that instead of sealing the DNA, it be returned to the individual in the same manner that it would be were there no probable cause. Finally, just to answer a question that Mr. Neumeier posed, if an individual is arrested for a felony, their DNA is collected, and ultimately the case is resolved on a misdemeanor basis, they would not be entitled to expungement under 609A because, by virtue of their misdemeanor conviction, the matter has not been determined in their favor. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Bass? All right. Teresa Nelson from the ACLU. Ms. Nelson, if you could introduce yourself for the record, and if you have anything new to add, that would be great. I know we have another committee coming in shortly.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Teresa Nelson. I'm the staff attorney for the ACLU of Minnesota. I want to thank you for letting me testify today. You do have my written testimony. In the interest of expediency, I'll just hit some of the highlights. We believe that House File 1244 represents an unwarranted intrusion into the privacy rights of individuals, and we urge you to oppose this wholesale expansion of the collection of DNA samples. Minnesota's DNA law was initially required DNA samples from a narrow set of individuals for which DNA analysis was helpful in solving the types of crimes that they've committed. It has grown incrementally over the years and will continue to grow incrementally unless the legislature draws the line at those felonies where DNA evidence is actually useful to collect. We know from experience that when the government collects vast amounts of information for one purpose, it's only a matter of time before that information gets used for other purposes. It's known as function creep, and there's no reason to believe that DNA collection is going to be treated any differently than Social Security numbers. Because DNA is different than fingerprints, we have serious concerns about the government collecting this information and retaining the samples indefinitely. There is no requirement that the sample is at some point returned to the person or destroyed, so it's kept indefinitely. And there's also no requirement that the sample itself be used solely for identification purposes. The DNA analysis that is done on the sample is required to be used for DNA for law enforcement identification purposes, and the amendment introduced today makes that clear. But the sample itself, the language of the bill is that DNA is the sample is conducted for the purpose of DNA identification, but not solely for that purpose. So to me that leaves open the ability or the possibility that in the future these samples could be used for different purposes. And in ways that we couldn't even imagine today. That raises some very serious concerns. Also, we have been unable to identify any legal barrier to sharing the actual sample with outside organizations outside. The profile that's created in the database is protected under this bill. It's private information. It can't be shared. But the sample itself, there doesn't seem to be anything in statute that says that this sample can only be used and cannot be shared outside law enforcement. That raises some serious concerns, especially when you consider the amount of information that is contained in a DNA sample. Finally, we believe that taking DNA from arrestees without individualized suspicion is questionable at best in terms of the constitutionality. The U.S. Supreme Court did uphold taking a blood sample from an arrestee in a case called Schmerber. However, in that case, the court said that there's got to be more than a mere chance that you might find evidence. There's got to be individualized suspicion that this blood sample is going to yield evidence. That's not the case conflicts with House File 1244. We also have concerns about the expungement process. I would echo Howard Bass's testimony that the samples should be returned when we're talking about people who are innocent or people who have been found to be innocent. Finally, we also have concerns about the permanent expansion of DNA samples for all felonies. It's simply unreasonable to think that somebody who's been convicted of embezzlement is going to produce a DNA sample that's going to yield results. It's unlikely that that person has committed crimes where DNA is going to be helpful. So I don't think that it's reasonable to have DNA collection from all felonies. And with that, I will end my testimony. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Nelson. Representative Paulson, we are going to need to lay this on the table to take up again at 4:30. I would like to try one thing with Representative Thiessen. When I asked whether there was discussion or questions, the only person who had any was De La Forest, who's not here right now. If we take that bill off the table, will there be discussion or questions? If so, we'll take it up this afternoon. But if not, we'll do it now. All right, Representative Thiessen, if you want to come back up, I'm going to take House File 1365 off the table. The chair will renew his motion that House File 1365, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Local Government Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you. We will, I know Mr. Verdon has a couple of announcements. We will recess as soon as he is done. We'll reconvene at 4:30 and take up our remaining three bills plus yours.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I have a question about schedule from here on out in terms of many of us already have other meetings scheduled at this point for today. Do you expect us, should we be clearing our 4 o'clock schedules from now on Monday and Wednesdays through the first deadline? I mean, do you expect a lot of this? Are we hearing? Seems like we're hitting a crunch time, and some of the committees were not. So it's hard for me to know if we're going to be extending quite a bit here.
Fair question, Representative Slawick, and it appears that we are. This and that has always been the case with this committee, but it looks like we have even more bills this year than normal. So we will likely be extending meetings on Mondays and Wednesdays going forward. We may even have to add extra days as we get closer. We may have some days where we can get it done by 2:15 or 2:30, but there will be times when we need to get up at 4:30.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
And just to say, I understand you'll be scheduling the more controversial bills during the regular committee time. And, you know, obviously we worry about having conflicts later in the day and a bill coming up that we are concerned about and then not being here because of a prior commitment. So, but you will work to do that?
Yes, that's a request as well. Thank you. Mr. Verdon had an announcement.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to remind everybody that on the 18th of March, we're having our hearing in Grand Rapids. And because of the controversy and the large number of people we expect there, there are a few administrative things that you need to think about. Number one, we have to give out tickets. And I only have two requests. Representative Ellison and Representative Solberg have requested tickets. But you all have first crack at a reasonable number of tickets. So I need to know that because they're printed and we'll distribute them on Monday. So please get that information to me. For those of you that are riding on the bus will leave the SOB at 6 a.m. on Friday the 18th. And remember, I'm an old soldier, and if you miss movement, that's the court-martial offense. So my planning all was designed on when that bus leaves. It's going to be televised. Several stations have contacted me. And because of a large number of people, we need you there by 10 o'clock so we can get you into the facility before the crowds get unruly or whatever could happen. Don't worry about security. We've coordinated with the Commissioner of Public Safety, the sheriff, and the local police. Lastly,
can we bring our concealed weapons?
Well, since Judge Finley threw that law out, I guess we go back to the strike that. The last thing was lunch. I've got lunch ordered for all the staff and the members. There will be meatless for those Catholics or anybody wants to observe Lent. And for a nominal fee, you can pay me when you're there. So everything is taken care of. I know the members that are traveling separately, please try to be at the Rife Center by 10 o'clock on that day. Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Burden, will it be the structure approximately starting at 10:30, the pro side goes for an hour, the con side goes for an hour, the committee meets for an hour, with the lunch break in there somewhere? Do we know what time that will be? Can you give us a little more
information? Mr. Chairman, yes, the schedule is at 10:30, the hearing will start. The author, Representative Severson, will have as much time as he wants to present the bill. Then the proponents will be given 60 minutes to testify. At 12 o'clock, we will break for a half an hour for lunch. At 12:30, we'll start up again. Depending on where we're at in the testimony, the opponents will be given 60 minutes. Then the bill will be returned to the committee for discussion, and we will vote by 2 o'clock.
Mr. Chair, how long will the committee have to discuss the bill? How long?
That doesn't sound like it will depend upon how much time we have before 2 o'clock. We have to be out of the facility. And I think the estimation is probably 10 hours.
Mr. Chair, the opponents don't start till 12:30, though, right?
Well, no.
No, we start at 10:30. The bill will be presented. The proponents will have an hour. We'll break for lunch regardless of where we are. At noon? At 12:30?
At noon.
Okay, and 12:30 we will come back and either finish the proponents or we may already be on the opponents. Each time about 60 minutes.
And Mr. Chair, we'll be taking a vote at 2 o'clock?
Yes, or earlier if discussion is.
Mr. Chair, just a question. Have we ever taken a vote outside the Capitol?
Representative Slavik, yes. I've heard from somebody that we've never done that. We checked with the chief clerk and he confirmed that, in fact, many times that's been done when the DFL was in charge. Committee sessions often had votes on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes. Anything further?
Mr. Chair, what was our final action on the A2 amendment to Representative Paulson's bill?
We adopted that.
We did adopt it.
Yes.
Okay.
We did. We will reconvene at 4:30 in the same room. Is that right?
Yes.
We're in recess. Thank you. All right. I will reconvene the Civil Law and Elections Committee, and I would like to take House File 1244 off the table. The motion before us, I believe, was mine. To recommend that House File 1244 as amended be recommended to pass and sent where again? To public safety. And we had heard testimony but had not gotten to discussion. So, are there questions or discussion on the bill? Representative Hilke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Paulson, if I understand the situation with this bill correctly, when a DNA analysis is done, it creates basically a computer-generated profile. Is that correct?
Representative Paulson.
I think that's correct. And I'll just go ahead. You don't need to answer that. And that's stored in a database, as well as the sample, the physical sample taken being stored by some means, I presume frozen. I believe the bill provides for the information gathered in the database to be shared with other law enforcement agencies, and I don't see any restriction there about whether those would be law enforcement agencies within the state or even within the country. So my question is, isn't providing for these records to be expunged at some point if the conditions warrant it kind of irrelevant once you have something in a digital form that can be sent to anybody anywhere in the world? I mean, that's sort of like my sending you an email and then at some later date erasing it from my sent item file. I mean, the information would still be out there, would still be capable of being sent and being retained by others, would it not?
Representative Paulson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilde, I just want to make sure I'm following your question, I guess exactly, is that I do not believe, and counsel, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't believe that the data is sent federally until there's a conviction. It does not go into the CODIS file. That's the testimony we've had from the BCA at this point. So it would remain within Minnesota, within the law enforcement community.
Representative Hilty?
Mr. Chair, Representative Paulson, within the law enforcement community, if this is records retained at the BCA in their computer, and it's sent, say, to the Hennepin County Sheriff, and the Hennepin County Sheriff receives that in the form of a digital file, there wouldn't be anything to, say, prevent the sheriff from copying that file and retaining it. You wouldn't have any means of recalling it. So I'm just saying that in that situation, what does it mean to say that these records will be expunged? Because they can still, you know, if they've been out, they're out. There's no way to get them back. I can see how you could destroy a physical sample, but I don't see how you could destroy the digital record in a database if it had ever left that database for any reason. And there isn't anything in the bill that says that it can't.
Representative Paulson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hilty, I believe the data as well as the sample, again, would be under the jurisdiction of the BCA. And I don't see the BCA folks here to... They said they'd be back to answer questions on that in terms of how they handle that data. I don't think it would be going to the Hennepin County Sheriff, for instance. It would be going to the BCA. So I don't think there are electronic files flying around here. I think the data is stored there, the sample stored there, and that's where the matches would be provided for if there were hits.
Representative Emmer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Paulson, listening to Representative Hilty's questions, it suddenly occurred to me that we have a lot of the same questions when it comes to our medical records, that we're now going to paperless and we're saving them, and we're trying to legislate or put in certain protections that will help the patient, help protect the patient's privacy. And I just want to confirm, because it seems to me that you tried to do the same thing with your bill. My understanding in your bill is, and please correct me if I'm wrong, number one, you're talking about this much like fingerprints. In other words, if somebody requests, under your proposed legislation, somebody requests this back after they have been proven innocent or charges have been dropped, it's going to be the responsibility of the agency that has possession of that sample to return it. Is that right?
Representative.
Sure, oh. Representative Emmerich, that's correct, yes.
And then getting to the, I guess following up on Representative Hilty's question then, the other part of your proposed bill, and I think it's part of one of the amendments we did earlier today, is that this is all private data, categorized as private data under the Government Data Practices Act, which my understanding is would preclude, it won't stop someone from doing something illegal or in violation of the law, but that law would preclude someone within the BCA or whatever the authority is that's holding this data or this sample from unauthorized communication to a third party. Is that correct?
Chair, Representative, I believe that's correct, yes.
And then just one more follow-up. Because the other thing that was important to me, and I know that I've had a discussion with at least one other member of the committee about protections in the event someone decides to violate the law. Is it correct, Representative Paulson, that the same remedies that are available to private citizens under the Government Data Practices Act, which I believe would include sanctions, attorney's fees, and actual costs, those would be available to someone in this circumstance or affected by your law if their DNA sample has been in violation sent on to a third party. Is that right?
That's impossible.
That is correct. That was specifically dealt with in one of the amendments that the committee adopted. Correct.
All right. Thank you.
Representative
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Paulson, you very graciously took a moment with me during the break to talk over an amendment I had in mind. It is on the A2 amendment.
and it would the amendment that my oral amendment, if assuming the rules allow me to do so, would be on line 13 and would be very simple. It would simply delete a comma, the word upon demand, and another comma. And so under my proposal it would read, where these conditions are met, comma, the Bureau and agency shall remove the person's information from the Bureau's combined DNA index system and return to the arrested person the biological specimen, blah, blah, blah. The idea here is that on the demand sort of puts the onus on the individual whose case, who has had his DNA taken, but whose case has been dismissed or declined by a prosecutor. And, you know, I think that, you know, since the case, this is no meritorious case, you know, maybe the government should, all on its own accord, give, you know, give you back your stuff and not require the person to make that demand. My thinking is that sometimes, you know, if you've got people who've been arrested and gone through the ordeal of being, having DNA taken, arrested, booked, fingerprinted, locked up, maybe for 36 hours, put on the orange jumpsuit, some of y'all know what I'm talking about in here. Okay. That's kind of an ordeal. And maybe they're just so happy to be out that they would forget all about making the demand. Would you be willing to delete those words on line, those words at the end of line 13 upon demand?
Representative Paulson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, yeah, I appreciate our conversation. I didn't have a chance to see you right before committee started. I didn't have a chance as well to talk to the BCA. But, I mean, at this time I will oppose it, but I'll continue to work with you. And the reasoning is this, is that I've tried to be very consistent on applying the same standard to fingerprints as we are to the DNA. So, I mean, there would be no difference here in terms of how that request upon demand would exist, is my understanding with the current statute. Secondly, I think there could be a cost. I just was just having a brief conversation with Mr. Dolish from the BCA regarding potential cost implications, and I think we'd have to... The bill will go back to public safety, and I know you're a member of that committee, Representative Olson, so I think... we may have to continue to work on that. That's my feeling right now.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just want to say that, you know, I do hope you seriously give this my proposal some consideration because, again, you know, part of the worry is that the government's just trying to collect the biggest database on its citizenry as it can. And if that's not really what's going on, and this really is about fighting crime, then why would you need it if you have a declined or dismissed case? That's just a remark. Mr. Chair, if I may, I also raise another issue just to get your reaction, Representative Paulson. There are only four states in these United States that have DNA taken on arrest. So this is sort of a radical, way out there sort of thing, in my opinion. 46 other states say that's going too far, or at least till up to today they have not taken that step. But even Virginia makes the point that, and I'm reading from their statute, that we're talking about violent arrests for violent felonies, not all. But even Virginia says that after a determination by a magistrate or grand jury that probable cause exists for the arrest, a sample shall be taken. What is your reaction to requiring that there be some judicial oversight before some sort of judicial determination that, you know, there's maybe this person really did something before we start sticking swabs in their mouth and clipping hair and fingernails and everything else? What is your thought on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, my initial reaction is that the bill is fine just the way it's laid out. And again, we're looking at the experiences in other states, just as you mentioned, and I think other states are going to move in this direction. So while there's only four states now, I think there are definitely going to be other states moving in this direction because it is absolutely saving lives, it's absolutely preventing crime and protecting victims, and it is exonerating innocent people. There's no doubt about that as well. In fact, I think in previous testimony we've had from the BCA, they said that under the existing database, they clear potentially up to 25% of their suspects. And so at this time, I don't think that provision would be needed. But that would be, I think, a good item for discussion under the purview of the Public Safety Committee.
Last question, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your patience with me. But can you comment directly, if you care to, on this question of having a judicial determination or a grand jury find that there's probable cause for this person, that probable cause that the crime was committed and that this person committed it before the DNA was taken? What about that judicial determination before we start taking DNA off people? What are your thoughts on that subject? Do you care to share? Do you have any thoughts on this?
Representative Paulson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Paulson, I don't have any, you know, real strong feelings other than to say that all the provisions that we have in the bill, including the amendments we've offered today, are to, as much as possible, model it as the same statutes that we have for fingerprints. And so there's really no difference for fingerprints. In fact, it's kind of interesting. I went back and looked at some newspaper articles in the 1930s and the mid-1900s, and all of the discussions we're having and potential opponents of the legislation we hear today are actually identical to when the discussion of taking fingerprints was taking place. There's no difference in any of the arguments we've had here today.
Finally, so you don't have any opinion on judicial oversight at this time?
Mr. Chair, at this point, I would hope that the committee here would oppose it. I would oppose it here. But, again, this has been a work in progress, and so I've been trying to work with some folks and moving the issue forward and have done that with the amendments that are here today, and I think we'll continue to do that in the Public Safety Committee.
Mr. Chair, what is the rule on oral amendments? Can I make an oral amendment today? Is there a 24-hour rule thing going on?
You can make an oral amendment as long as it's what is the rule? Technical, right? Okay, as long as it's technical, which this would be, I think, short.
Okay, well, I want to return back to my proposed amendment to that's really on the A2 amendment, line 13. And I would make an oral amendment, Mr. Chair, to delete at the end of that line 13, to delete the words upon demand. And I would so move that amendment.
Representative Elson, and you'd want to delete the comma after shall?
Yeah. Right. Both commas and upon demand.
Representative Ellison moves to amend the bill as amended, and we find that on the A2 amendment, line 13. After the word shall, delete comma, upon demand, comma. Representative Ellison, you've kind of already explained it. Anything else?
Nothing else. I just renew my motion.
Representative Paulson?
No further comments.
Okay. Any further discussion on this? All those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No.
Oh.
Motion does not prevail. Amendment is not adopted. Representative Simon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Paulson, just a quick question. What is the principal basis for limiting the scope of this bill to felony arrests? I note that, as many of us remember, Timothy McVeigh, for example, was discovered because he was arrested for speeding, which is not a felony, and although that didn't involve DNA, the lesson there, at least for me, is that oftentimes you can nab people on minor offenses that are later tied to much larger and more monstrous crimes. Have you or any of the other people with whom you've worked on this given any thought to that? In other words, why the bright line at felonies?
Representative Paul.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, I've not given any other thought beyond that. Again, other states have gone in the direction of felony arrestees, and, a felony-level crime is a pretty serious crime. You'd be the first to suggest to go to a lower level, I guess, if... You know, that would be your prerogative, I think, to offer that as an amendment or consideration, I suppose. But I have not had discussions or gone that direction.
Any further discussion? Representative Hilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just back to the question that I raised initially that I think Representative Emmer was attempting to address. I just want to clarify, I was not talking about unauthorized use of the information or access to it. And since we do have someone from the BCA here now, I would like to pursue that just a little bit further. The section of the bill that I'm referring to is on page 7, section 6, subdivision 3. Says the Bureau's centralized system may only be accessed by authorized law enforcement personnel and used solely for law enforcement purposes. And my question is, what law enforcement personnel would be authorized to have access to the system, and would access to the system and sharing information with authorized personnel involve digital transfer of any of this information?
Mr. Dulles, could you reintroduce yourself for the record, please?
Sure.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, my name is Frank Dolish. I'm the director of the BCA Laboratory. Although this is new language, I don't think this is any different than how we are handling this offender database currently. And the information that we are sharing would be the profiles of these individuals minus their names goes to the FBI national database that can be searched against with criminal cases in other jurisdictions. And so somebody from Wisconsin or Texas or wherever can search that database. If they get a hit on that profile from the national database, they're told to contact Minnesota. We keep the names and the profiles separate. They're kept on separate computers and servers, and we have a link between them. So that state would contact us. We would verify. They would send us their information. We'd verify that there is a match. At that point, we would, if they're a legitimate law enforcement agency, we would tell them that we had a match. Then they would go back to their jurisdiction and ask that a sample be drawn. And that sample that would be drawn at that, it would give them probable cause to get a sample from that individual. And so that would be what they would use to go to court on. The database hit just gives them a way of identifying that person as a suspect on that case. In terms of in Minnesota, the data is only available to those people that are authorized in our DNA section and in the Hennepin County Sheriff's Department DNA section. They can search against that database, and again, they would, if they get a hit from one of our forensic cases against that, we would verify that by going back and getting the original sample and rerunning it. Once we've done that, we would tell the law enforcement agency. They would go out and, using that as probable cause, get another sample that would be used for the criminal case. That database, the profiles, are not able to be accessed by anybody else. We do have and we keep the names separate for another reason. The names we keep out there so that when corrections or a sheriff's office gets somebody that's been recently convicted of a felony under the current law, they can check that database, and if we already have a sample from that individual, they do not have to take another one. So we're not repeating, because you're aware that a lot of these people do these things multiple times, and we're trying to prevent duplication of effort, if you will. But the profiles are not available electronically except as I've described. So if you're a sheriff or a chief or work for corrections, you do not have access to that information.
And Mr. Chair, just so I understand this, Mr. Doge, you have the profiles digitally stored in Minnesota, and also you transmit a copy of that profile to the FBI database. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's correct. And at this point, that does not include juveniles, because until the Justice for All Act that passed last year, juveniles weren't allowed to be sent to the national database. That law has changed, and sometime in the near future, juveniles will be allowed at the national database.
And, sir, At what point in the process would those profiles be transferred or transmitted to the FBI database? Would that be before some determination was made about whether these profiles should be kept or needed to be expunged? And if it's before that determination is made, then do you have the capability of expunging profiles from the FBI database?
Mr. Dolan?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, if a sample is expunged, yes, we can remove it from the federal database. Under current FBI rules, under current federal law, we will only be able to send, under current law, we can only send convicted to the national database. Under the Justice for All Act that just passed, we will be restricted to convicted or arrested individuals that will be able to go to the national database. The FBI does allow states to keep at the state level any samples that are collected and authorized by their state law, for example, Virginia.
Thank you. All right. Seeing no further discussion, I will renew my motion that House File 1244 be recommended to pass, as amended, be recommended to pass, and we refer to the Public Safety Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye. No. Whatever.
Motion prevails. Thank you. All right. The next item on the agenda is House File 822, Representative Blaine's bill. And I will also move this bill. I'll move that House File 822 be recommended to pass and re-referred. I'm sorry, that House File 822 be held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus elections bill. Representative Blaine, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Mr. Chair and members, I will try and be a little more brief than our majority leader was with his bill.
We would appreciate that. Thank you.
Members, House File 822 is a bill that would promote the possible use of an alley system in school district elections in the state of Minnesota. I brought this bill out to the Education Policy Committee in relation to a request from my home school district in Little Falls. And the bill was amended in that committee to go statewide with this legislation. And I will, for the members here, I'll go through the bill rather quickly here too, and break it down for you. What the alley system does is it creates at-large seats which allow non-incumbents to challenge a single board member for that board member's seat rather than have non-incumbents run on an at-large basis against all the incumbents at once. One of the reasons that I feel so strongly about this bill, and I think many others on the Education Committee as it passed out of there, I think without a dissenting vote, is it engages a better dialogue during the campaign season for school board seats, and it draws candidates to focus more on issues. We feel that is probably really what the taxpayers and the school board is all about, and about addressing issues. Members, if you look at the bill, subdivision 1 of section 1 creates the establishment which would allow any school board to pass a resolution establishing the alley system. And school board seats would be numbered. Subdivision 2 contains the language for the filing dates. Subdivision 3 requires an affidavit of candidacy for each of those positions. Subdivision 5 is just the how the heading of the ballot would read, and Subdivision 5 allows discontinuance. It means that this would be a system that would be decided upon by the school board they would pass a resolution to allow this and also to discontinue it. And Subdivision 6 states how incumbents would serve their term out if the school board would pass a resolution to begin or end an alley system. Members, this is not a new concept. The alley system is currently being used in the Rochester School District and also in the Alexandria School District, and we've had people from those districts comment to us that the system works very well. Mr. Chair and members, I would appreciate your support of this bill.
Thank you, Representative Blaine. Questions or discussion on the bill? Is there anyone who would like to testify for or against this bill in the audience? All right. Representative Westrom.
Chair, Representative Blaine, I hope I didn't miss this in your testimony, but did you say this was basically voluntary or this would change the whole, the way all school board elections are run?
Representative Blaine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Westrom and members, this would not be a mandate to school districts across the state. School districts would have the option to run their election on an alley system, or they could run on the current system that they have now.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Blaine, how can Rochester and Alexandria do it now? If it's allowed under law, couldn't other schools do it, or do they have a special exemption?
Representative Blaine?
Mr. Chair and Representative Westrom, both Rochester and Alexandria have come before the legislature in the past and have gotten approval to do and run their election on an alley system. Representative Westrom and members, when I brought this bill in front of the Education Policy Committee and the discussion that we had in that committee, we amended. I brought this bill forward for the Independent School District 42, which is Little Falls. It was through the advice of and an urging of the Education Policy Committee that we go statewide with this, so as that we don't have individual school districts coming down here year after year asking for the permission to engage in an alley system. So what we're going to do is we're going to give the option to school districts across the state, not a mandate, but give them the option to, and they will then have, through local control, the ability to decide for themselves.
All right. Seeing no further discussion, I will renew my motion that House File 822 be held over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Elections Bill. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Blaine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Sertich, House File 898. I will move House File 898 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register.
Mr. Chair. A few more stops. This one has to go to public safety.
Public safety.
Yep.
All right. My motion will be that it be re-referred to public safety. And Representative Sertich, are all three of these amendments yours?
They are, Mr. Chair.
Okay. How would you like to do those?
Mr. Chair, if I could do a brief overview of the bill and then take the amendments in a pretty easy order for you.
That's great.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, come before you today with a bill, department bill, actually, that is on a long and interesting journey that started in Commerce Committee, is now in your committee, goes to public safety, and finally ends up in jobs. I get to meet most of the freshman members this way by heading through all the committees, I guess. This is the Department of Employment and Economic Development bill and basically deals with unemployment insurance. I have the honor of serving on the Unemployment Insurance Task Force, which is a highly entertaining task force that meets during the summer. It's myself and Representative Gunther in the House, and there are folks from the business community, labor, small employers, large employers, that sit around the table and figure out how we can do unemployment insurance better. Basically, for those of you that are not as familiar with the program, the unemployment insurance program provides temporary benefits to qualified persons that have worked through no fault of their own, and these benefit payments replace part of the income lost while the worker is in between jobs. Before you today, we come before you today with the changes that have been agreed upon by employers and employees and all respective parties. The major thrust of this deals with SUTA dumping, which is State Unemployment Tax Act dumping that was passed on a federal level almost unanimously supported by the president and most federal folks. What happens is the SUTA dumping is basically tax evasion. Companies that have a high experience rating, and that's how how unemployment insurance is paid, that have a high experience rating, sometimes get another shell company, and they move all their employees from their high rating to this new company, and they avoid their taxes. This is obviously bad for many individuals. It's bad for the unemployment insurance fund. It's bad for all the employees, and it's also bad for all the employers that are playing by the rules. It's a small number of people, we think, but when these folks are evading their taxes, it's affecting other businesses who have to make up the difference at the same time, and we're trying to catch them. So the thrust of this bill, why it's here today, deals with the penalties and the process of that, which we can address as we go through the bill. Mr. Chair and members, we had some lengthy discussions, and my first few amendments pretty much put the bill, the First Amendment, if I could take it, Mr. Chair, would be the 805-0190 amendment.
All right, I will move the 805 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What this bill does, portion does, and through the process we're finding all the bugs in the bill, and that's maybe the good news about going to four committees. This just helps the department in their collection of data when they owe a refund to different employers when mistakes are made as far as refunding money. It doesn't deal as much in this committee, and I understand that. But this just makes it easier for the department to go back and set a date and time with their records. This makes it doable for them where they can go back in their records and set the refund. Very basic language, non-controversial.
All right, any discussion on the 805 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The 805 amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair, if I could take the 805-0157 amendment next.
All right, and let me clarify. That was this last amendment was the 805-0190 amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
I will move the 805-0157 amendment. Representative Sertich.
Mr. Chair, this deals with an issue that came up in the last committee, and I made a promise to Chair Wilkin and the committee that we'd work on an issue dealing with professional employee organizations. They needed some language in here to feel that they're okay. We've got representatives from their organization in the room who have signed off on this. The folks on the UI have signed off on it. I could go into the details, but just know that we had the trust of the other committee to deal with this issue. All sides are agreed upon it, with one minor change, if I can make an oral amendment briefly to it.
Sure, go ahead.
On the final page, page 6, line 28, we change the to an. And, Mr. Chair, perhaps you could incorporate that into your
motion. I will incorporate into this amendment, page 6, line 28, delete the word the prior to employer and insert the word an. A-N. Discussion on the 0157 amendment. Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. That amendment is adopted. And then I will move the 0050178 amendment. Representative Sertich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now we're getting into the meat of maybe some issues that the Civil Law Committee would care about, just the hearing process and also the penalties. And for this information, I want to turn over to my expert witness.
All right. Mr. Nelson, if you could introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am Lee Nelson.
I am the Unemployment Insurance Legal Affairs Director for the Department of Employment and Economic Development. As to this particular bill, it has been agreed upon, or the amendment to this bill, it has been agreed upon by various interest groups. And what we are doing here is substituting a request for reconsideration process in place of what is now the second level of appeals. All parties have agreed to that. The State Chamber, the AFL-CIO, and other interest groups are all in favor. What this particular, that is already in the bill. What this particular amendment does is add a lot of specificity surrounding what the notices have to say and makes it very clear of parties' rights as to how a request for reconsideration will be done. There is one other thing that this amendment does, and this does change the current bill and current law to some extent, and that is found on page 10. What it does is change the standard of review by the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Any party who's ultimately dissatisfied with an agency decision can request the Court of Appeals to review it. We are asking this committee to adopt the standards set forth in the Administrative Procedures Act, which is applicable to all other state agencies. And I don't believe that this has a real change. It really doesn't change at all how the Court of Appeals looks at these cases, but it just specifies very clearly the standard rather than in a common law standard where the court uses different words like reasonable evidence rather than substantial. So I don't believe it changes how the Court of Appeals will handle a case, but makes it very clear how they handle that case. It's the same as they do any other administrative case in that court.
Mr. Nelson, was there a particular problem with the old appeal system that prompted this?
Mr. Chairman, yes. It became very expensive. We're very far behind. And plus, you get to the question of why does there need to be a two-step process, which is a full review. You've already held an evidentiary hearing and a decision issued, parties and appeals, and it's a full review of the complete record. Essentially, you almost start over. Simply too far behind and can't handle that process and going forward in the future, given our reduced resources.
Questions or discussion on the amendment? All right, I have made the motion to adopt the AO50178 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Sertich, anything else on the bill?
Mr. Nelson would like to speak briefly to the penalties. I don't know if that falls under the purview of this committee, and he can talk a bit about the penalties.
Okay, Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, federal law, which passed, actually it was unanimously passed Congress, signed by the President in August, requires each state to impose meaningful civil and criminal penalties on any employer who attempts to avoid their unemployment taxes by moving workers, between related corporations. So what we've done here is put in some penalties. When our first stab at it was actually rejected by the United States Department of Labor as insufficient. So they have passed on this and said they are meaningful. The penalty for an employer who moves workers around and fails to tell the agency, what this bill does is require all employers who move workers between related corporations to tell the department. We will then move the experience rating to that new employer. If they fail to tell us, the law provides for a minimum penalty of $5,000 or 2% of the first total quarterly payroll, which should have been moved, or was moved, excuse me, whichever is higher. So it is a very meaningful penalty on especially a large employer, and it is meant so that they will not do anything to avoid their unemployment taxation. And like I say, as Representative Sertich, the business community is fully in favor of this because every time an employer does this, and it simply means everyone else has to pay higher taxes.
Mm-hmm. Discussion on the bill or questions? Representative DeLaForest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question for Mr. Nelson. Representative Sertich, I think this is a fine bill, but I have two questions. First of all, where does the federal government get authority to regulate in this area? Is this the ever-expanding Commerce Clause that we have to blame for this?
Mr. Nelson.
Chairman, Representative Forrest, I won't profess that much knowledge of constitutional law, but what I will say is that federal law gets fairly complex. There's a Federal Unemployment Tax Act, and all employers in Minnesota are required to pay federal unemployment taxes. Now, the federal government gives a 90% credit so long as your state law complies with federal law. The state of Minnesota can do what it pleases, but it means that all Minnesota employers will lose a federal tax credit. That tax credit is presently worth $378 per worker. If the state of Minnesota chooses not to pass this bill, it's worth probably $800 million in lost tax credits to employers each year. That's the penalty is so stiff as to compel you to do it.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Of course, you answered my second question, which is what is the penalty for telling Washington to pound sand on this? And I've learned in prep, well, nobody's been on the committee with me understands my ongoing and losing fight to honor the true concept of federalism. But in this one, it looks, again, like our hands are tied. So I'll ask the question, but unfortunately, I think I know the answer that, again, we smell the rotten fish of the Commerce Clause and all this stuff. Thanks.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative De La Forest, I'm not sure if that $800 million is really the carrot or the stick, but I see your point.
I feel pain.
Further discussion? All right. Anything further, Representative Sirdis?
No, Mr. Chair.
Excuse me. I will renew my motion that House File 898, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Public Safety Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.